Imagine my surprise when I was sitting in our daughter's family room in Dook outside Ballyclare, and suddenly a shark began moving around the room. Seriously, I'm not joking. There was a shark there, and it was floating in the air, moving around as if it was in the sea. And then a crocodile came out from behind one of the armchairs, and I was lifting my feet off the floor, and the grandchildren were laughing at me. They thought this was hilarious. I could hardly believe my eyes, but then I shouldn't have believed my eyes because it wasn't real. There were no shark, there were no crocodile. Google. Oh, what would we do without Google? It, of course, can have all sorts of 3D animals in your living room. Virtual reality is such an amazing thing, isn't it? I remember visiting the Transport Museum in Belfast a few years ago when I managed to return to Earth from the International Space Station on a Russian Soyuz spacecraft without even leaving the ground. It was amazing. The technology available today is so good that it's hard to know sometimes what's real and what isn't real. But actually, that's always been an issue for us human beings. Knowing what's real and what's not. It's just that technology now seems to blur the lines in ways that weren't possible before. It's easier than ever for us to find ourselves not living in the real world, as we so often maybe say about other people. Oh, she doesn't live in the real world at all, you know. And it impacts our lives in different ways, to a greater or lesser extent, of course, affecting our relationships and our behavior, our beliefs and thinking, fake news, deep fake on the internet, taking pictures from people's Facebook pages, Instagram accounts, and so on and so forth, and then taking heads off their bodies and putting it onto other bodies, and then posting it afresh as if this is the person that's involved in these kinds of activities. It's a huge doorway these days for child abuse, for taking images of children off family Facebook pages and so on, and then adapting those photos to in a pornographic way and to put them back out there so that people don't know that that's fake, that that's not real. There are dangers, and young people, please, please, please be aware. There are huge dangers. Oh, there's huge benefits to it, yes, but there are huge dangers, and I don't think the government has got a handle on that yet. And the promotion of the Prime Minister about AI and all the rest of that, oh dear, it sends shivers up my spine sometimes to think about the potential that there is there for damage and for harm, as well as for good. We need to be careful. But of course, people have always allowed fantasy to influence reality. It's not something that only happens in our day and age because of the technology we have. Take what happens in when it comes to people's belief or not believing in God. From the earliest of days, people have allowed their imaginations to run away with them, informing their ideas about what God is like, about what God does, about how God is to be worshipped. And at times they have lost sight of the reality of the living and the true God, the one and only, persuading themselves, in fact, that there's no such thing as God at all, or substituting for the real God things that are not God at all. The sun, the moon, the stars. images made out of metal or wood or stone, fertility gods, weather gods, war gods, deified emperors and kings and rulers. All the time, ignoring the truth God has revealed about himself clearly and unmistakably, as Paul comments in Romans 1:25, they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served created things rather than the Creator. Well, that comment describes exactly what was going on in the world of Elijah's day. The people around him in Israel had turned to other gods, the gods of the neighboring nations around them. Baalism had become the popular religion at that time. It was a religion in which there were many gods, gods who controlled the sun, the rain, the wind, gods who granted fertility not just to the ground but also to people and to animals, gods who had to be placated and appeased, even to the extent of sacrificing children for fear of severe punishment for anyone who failed to keep them happy. The Baals were many, and their hold over people was strong. Because such gods, of course, are made in the image of those who create them. People with corrupt minds and deceitful hearts. And so the gods they design are perhaps the most ruthless and cruel of all. They promise much, but deliver very little, except pain and heartache and despair, as Elijah would publicly verify in a powerful demonstration to the people of Israel and their neighbors, as he showed in no uncertain terms that the Lord is the only living and true God, and that Baal is no God at all. It was the third year now from the first time Elijah had delivered his red weather warning to King Ahab. As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, there will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years except at my word. Ahab hadn't seen hilt nor hair of Elijah from that moment, in spite of the fact that he had searched everywhere for him, not only in Israel, not only in Judah, but even in the surrounding nations, looking for where Elijah had gone to hide. And now here they were, standing face to face again. "Well, would you look who it is," said Ahab, "the troublemaker." "Oh, I'm not the troublemaker in Israel. You are, Ahab. You and your father before you, abandoning the Lord's commands and worshiping the Baals, and I'll prove it to you. Assemble the people together on Mount Carmel, and be sure to bring your precious Jezebel's 450 Baal prophets and 400 Asherah prophets with you." So Ahab, we're told, sent word all over Israel about a great public rally he was holding on Mount Carmel with Elijah. That would take a bit of time, wouldn't it, to organize and to send word around? And so we must assume that a few days passed before the rally itself took place, with Ahab traveling the 20 miles or so from his summer palace in Jezreel back across the Jezreel Valley by chariot early in the morning on the day of the rally to the site on the slopes of Mount Carmel where everyone was gathering, including Jezebel's 450 prophets of Baal. it appears that the 400 Asherah prophets stayed away. They didn't come. Now think about this for a moment. That's a lot of people gathering there, isn't it? Between Jezebel's prophets, 450, the royal administration and household who were there, they would have come as an entourage and they would have made sure that there was food for the king to eat. I mean, this could be a long day. His palace was 20 miles away. So they probably came across and set up what we would now describe as a gazebo. They maybe had a few barbecue things there that they could cook food on and so on for him at whatever time of the day the king decided he wanted to eat. This was a big day out. And there were crowds of people there. There was residents from Jezreel, no doubt, and other towns around that valley. So you're already talking about maybe 1,000 people. Before you add in anyone from around the rest of the country who decided to make the journey to Mount Carmel to see what this was all about and what was going to take place. And given that after his challenge ended, Elijah instructs the people to seize all the prophets of Baal, the 450 of them, there must have been at least another, 1,000, 2,000 people present? Big numbers. This was a day like the day Jesus fed the 5,000. This was the kind of crowd that we're talking about here. You see, Mount Carmel is more of a mountain range than it is a single peak. If you look at the map of Israel, it's the bit that sticks out into the Mediterranean Sea. And it continues on inland for quite a bit. And not far up the slopes overlooking the Jezreel Valley, not overlooking the Mediterranean Sea, the inland side of the mountain, the bit overlooking the Jezreel Valley, to this day, you will find a sort of natural amphitheater, almost now covered over with trees and bushes. And there is the remains of a well from which Elijah would have drawn his water as the people gathered round to witness these amazing events. Sometimes when we look at the Bible telling us things like this event, we tend to treat it as a wee bit of a fairy tale. But young folks in particular tonight, this is real. You can go and see this place today. I have stood there myself. You can see it. It's real. It's not a fairy tale. These things happened. Archaeologists have proven so much of what's contained in this book today that we can rely on it. We can trust it. And so Elijah addresses the crowd. How long are you going to sit on the fence as to who the real God is? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him. The people then agree his proposal for a contest by which the true God could be identified. An animal sacrifice was to be prepared on two altars, one for Baal, the other for the Lord. Whichever God consumed the sacrifice with fire would be declared the true God. Cute thinking on Elijah's part, I have to say. Didn't Jezebel's prophets tell the people that Baal controlled the elements? Well, now was Baal's chance to prove it. Elijah invites his opponents to go first. Without hesitation, they prepared their altar and initiated the familiar rituals associated with Baal worship. They chanted and they danced around the altar from morning until midday. Elijah couldn't help himself. He began to mock them. He taunted them and laughed at them until they got themselves into such a frenzy that they began to cut themselves with their swords and spears. But, says verse 29, there was no response. No one answered. No one paid any attention. I guess around 2:30 or so, Elijah called a halt to their antics and began to prepare his own sacrifice. They'd had several hours to get Baal to respond. Now it was Elijah's turn to ask the Lord to reveal his power and authority. Oh, everything that had happened in Elijah's life so far had been in preparation for this moment. The Lord had proved to him at the Kereth Ravine and in the widow's home in Zarephath that the Lord could be trusted absolutely to do what he said he could do. He is sovereign over things, over people, and over spiritual realities. And now the Lord would prove it to Israel, yes, and to the nations round about. Now he would show the folly of trusting in anything other than him alone. Now he would make it clear that he is the true God and that Baal is no God at all. Elijah chose his time carefully. The time appointed for the evening sacrifice, the 9th hour, 3:00 in the afternoon. He chose his spot carefully. He repaired an altar that had been used over many years to offer sacrifices to the Lord, but now had lain in ruins through neglect. He chose his actions carefully. He wanted to make sure that no one could accuse him of cheating, so he had the whole altar doused with water 3 times until the trench that he had dug around it was full. And he chose his words carefully. There was no ranting. There was no raving. There was no ritual dance. Simply a prayer. Verses 36 and 37 tell us, at the time of sacrifice, the prophet Elijah stepped forward and prayed. Think about that. He could have fallen on his knees beside the altar and quietly prayed to the Lord, asking all that he asks in this prayer, but hardly anybody would have heard him. That was a safe route, wasn't it? Safe. Because nobody would have known what he had just asked the Lord for. So if nothing happened, well, he could have made excuses. He could have got out of it. He could have used a bit of spin like any good politician would. But no. He stepped forward. He didn't go back. He didn't drop down. He stepped forward and he prayed. Prayed out loud. O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, so these people will know that you, O Lord, are God and that you are turning their hearts back again. Wow. Talk about putting your money where your mouth is. This was risky stuff for Elijah. There was no hiding place for him. Either the Lord would answer him or Elijah would be shown up as a charlatan and a self-deluded fool, and Ahab could rightly have punished him by death as a result. He would indeed then have been the troublemaker in Israel. But Elijah needn't have worried. The fire of the Lord fell and burned up the sacrifice, the wood, the stones, and the soil, and also licked up the water in the trench. Oh, that makes it sound very matter of fact, doesn't it? Dull, even. But it must have been ferocious. Like a lightning bolt striking the earth. We've seen images of that on our television screens recently in the Los Angeles fires, haven't we? Scary, scary stuff. Fire, flames, smoke, heat, fear. It must have been awesome. One moment they were cynically listening to the voice of one man talking to the Lord. The next, they heard the roar of fire so intense that it consumed everything, the sacrifice, the wood, the stones, the soil, and the water, everything. They must have been petrified. A display of power like that would make even the bravest of people shudder with fear. And without any hesitation whatsoever, they exclaimed, "The Lord is God, not Baal." Yes, the Lord had brought his people back to their senses as Elijah had prayed he would. And at Elijah's command, verse 40, they seized Jezebel's 450 prophets and set about the awful task of dragging them down the hillside to their death at the Kishon River below. Now it appears, as I said earlier, that while all of these events were taking place, the king's entourage must have been preparing a meal for him. Bit of an outdoor barbecue, I suppose. Well, they just witnessed one of incredible power. Now they were hoping that the meat wouldn't be just as burned as the sacrifice had been. How could the king be expected to go without food all day? I mean, he's the king. And so Elijah tells Ahab to eat the meal while he has the chance, verse 41. Because he could hear the sound of a heavy rain. Does that remind you of anything? The sound of a heavy rain? Day of Pentecost. When the followers of Jesus were together in the upper room, what did they hear? The sound of a rushing wind. It wasn't that suddenly this wind came into the room and all the papers were blown about all over the place. And I know it was the sound they heard. The sound of a rushing wind. You ever heard that? I was telling friends recently about lying in bed at night in the manse in Dunadry when there was a storm. And it seemed to me that I could hear the wind start about Aldergrove and come across the fields behind and build in its power and in its sound, and then hit the manse and the slates on the roof would tingle, and then off the wind would go and it would quiet and down again till the next bit of wind would build, and you could hear the sound of it across the fields, and then bang would hit the house and on it would go again. On this day, Elijah heard the sound of a heavy rain. And as Ahab sat down and ate that meal, Elijah and his servant climbed to the top of Carmel, where he sat down with his head between his knees, probably mentally drained. "Go and look toward the sea," he told his servant. Verse 43. There's nothing there," he replied. Elijah kept sending him back again until the seventh time. Verse 44, he reported, "A cloud as small as a man's hand is rising from the sea." That was enough for Elijah. He jumped up, he ran down to Ahab, and he told him to get back to his chariot and head home the 20 miles across the valley to Jezreel before the rain stopped him. Can you see the look of disbelief on their faces as Elijah said this to them. What? Are you serious? Not a cloud in the sky. But Elijah told them, go before you can't. Well, that cloud, the size of a man's hand, quickly grew in size until the rain began, and the rain quickly became a monsoon. And as Ahab rode off in his chariot across the plain towards Jezreel, the ground would have become a quagmire. We've seen it again, haven't we, in flash floods. That's what would have happened here. The ground just became mud. The wheels of chariots don't much like mud, do they? So he was no doubt bogged down in this mud. And Elijah, energized by the Lord, not in terms of speed, notice here, not in terms of speed, but in terms of perseverance. This was a marathon length that Elijah was about to run, 20-something miles. It wasn't about speed. The Lord took care of the chariot and the mud. But he gave Elijah, who was no athlete, he gave Elijah the ability to run, probably on the drier bits, the harder bits of ground around the edge of the valley, so that he could get to Jezreel before Ahab, even though he had a horse pulling his chariot. The Lord had fulfilled his promise. Go and present yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the land. The people had recognized their sin and had turned back to the Lord, and the Lord blessed them as he said he would, with rain. Not so much showers of blessing as downpours of blessing. You know, folks, it's all too easy for any of us, people like you and me, and not just those with little or no time or thought for God. It's easy for people like us to exchange the truth of God for a lie at times, and to live as if he doesn't exist or as if he doesn't matter. It's so easy. We just have to do things our own way for that to be the case. And sometimes it takes a Carmel-type experience to bring us back to the reality so far as our relationship with the Lord is concerned. An experience that highlights our sinfulness, our weakness, our frailty, even our mortality. It could be through an accident or illness, through our business collapsing or being made redundant, through family problems or financial difficulties. It could be through the death of a loved one or a good friend, through a marriage breakdown, through mental ill health because of pressures at school or at work or at home. What are we to do? What is God saying to us? The same thing that he was saying to the people of Elijah's day through Elijah at Carmel. Come back to me. The Lord is the only God who can be fully trusted, because he hasn't been made in our image. He has made us in his. And he has made himself known to us in a personal way, his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. And through Jesus, we can know the Lord and experience the reality of his presence with us in our lives. This is why Jesus says to us in Matthew 11:28, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Where do you stand with the Lord today? Have you drifted away from him over the years? Started well, but maybe tailed off a wee bit recently. Unintentionally, perhaps, but still drifted away. Are you wavering between two opinions? To continue to live your own way or to follow God's way? If you agree that the God of the Bible, the God who demonstrated his power through Elijah at Mount Carmel and through Jesus Christ at Calvary, is the real God, you can't just stop there. You mustn't just stop there. If the Lord is God, said Elijah to the people, follow him. And isn't that what Jesus says to each one of us today? Follow me. Folks, this isn't just an intellectual exercise, assenting to some important spiritual truths. It's about giving the Lord his rightful place in our lives by faith. It's about living life his way by faith. And we too will enjoy his showers of blessing. Let's pray together.